God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can. Okay. Now I'd like to introduce tonight's speaker. I've gotten to know a little bit over the time of the conference here. We also exchanged a few emails over the last 6 months. He has an excellent message of recovery and an excellent message of living sober. So please join me in welcoming tonight's speaker, Bill C. from Torrance, California.
Bill, alcoholic. So did they make you come up here when you had one day, 3 years, and you're still here? I think that's cruel and unusual punishment. And the guy was 59 years. How do we know that's real? You could have just walked out of this.
Yeah, 59 years, I'm from Canada.
I'd like to thank the committee, Al and Tommy, Jim and Margarita, for inviting me to come here and being nice to me mostly. And yeah, I'm covered now. Yeah. It's really a... strange guy, isn't he? Strange guy? A strange man. There's some weird people here. This is really... Karen and I were up in the room today. What the hell are we doing here? How did we end up in Pattaya?
Lucky.
Yeah. Very lucky. It is an adventure. I mean, coming from where we come from, to show up anywhere and share the word is really extraordinary. Most of us come from a place where nobody was listening to much we had to say for a long time. And today that's all changed. So it's really a treat to be here. And now that you've seen that I do have a coat, I'm taking it off. People have a real sweat problem in this part of the world. Beats the hell out of the freezing cold, though. Last year I was in Alaska. It was 20 below. And I told those people, you should move. You'd think you'd get it by now, you know? What's true? You know, a really odd thing happened to me in March of 1985. I got sober. And what a remarkable experience that is. Remember? You know, sometimes we forget. Sometimes we forget. We get used to being sober. It becomes normal. It becomes okay. And we start whining about regular life problems that we never had before. I love the thing about, you know, I've got problems in areas where I never had areas before, you know. I mean, you know, and we get used to it, and we kind of forget, I think, the extraordinary experience of being awakened. Because isn't that what happened? I mean, people have been talking to us for years, and finally one day we go, maybe I drink too much. I mean, this is like new information, you know? And we stop. We just stop drinking. It's as if, I think, that it is taken away from us. It's not like we gave anything up. It gets taken away. Early on, my sponsor told me, he says, we're alcoholics, we don't quit anything. It gets taken from us. And the rest of this journey of awakening is to take this awakening and turn it into some kind of an awareness where I'm actually aware that I'm awake. An odd thing happened to me. In March of 85, I got sober. Well, in March of 1954, my dad got sober. He got fired from a job And rather than go to the bar, he came home. And I'm pretty sure it was my mother that called Alcoholics Anonymous. And he went to a meeting in Inglewood, California on Western Avenue on March the 28th of 1954. And he came back from that meeting and he told my mother, he says, you know, those people have got something down there and I'm going to go find out what it is. So the next night she went with him in order to monitor the experience. She walked into that Alano Club with him, and this woman immediately came right up to her because she looked out of place and asked her what she was doing there. And she says, well, I'm here with my husband to make sure that he fills out the form and gets registered and pays the dues and, you know, that kind of stuff. And this woman took my mother into the other room. Don't make Al-Anon jokes if you don't know what it is. A lot of people make stupid Al-Anon jokes because they have no idea what it is. But if you know what it is, you can make some great Al-Anon jokes. Stop and think of the consciousness of an individual that would live with us on purpose. It's like, what are they thinking? Oh, this will be fun. When my father died in 1999, he was 45 years sober. My mother died in 2002, in February of 2002. She was 48 years in Al-Anon. So on top of all my other problems, I was raised in an AA house. I don't recommend that. There is nothing worse than living in a house with two people with clear eyes that know exactly what's going on in your head. It's extremely difficult to get away with anything. But I was raised in AA. And back in those days, in the mid-50s, they were building Alcoholics Anonymous, like is happening here. I mean, Alcoholics Anonymous is still growing, contrary to what a lot of people say. It's growing, and it's alive and as vibrant and as effective as it has ever been. I think it's better. In the United States, there's access to recovery on all levels of the society. My kids, I've got younger kids, well, they're in their 20s now, but growing up in school while I was sober, they were telling them about it. We show up at schools and high schools and stuff. You know, the kids are coming in. Have you noticed the children are coming now? Have you seen them? Do you get young kids that are 16, 17, 18 years old coming in here to get sober? In Southern California, in the South Bay where I live, they have taken over. You know, and there's a lot of the old bastards are pissy about that.
Well, we're not a daycare center.
You know, there's like the illusion that the kids are coming to AA because it's so hip. I mean, Alcoholics Anonymous has offered me a level of lameness that I did not know was available. You know? Matter of fact, you got to lame up to get AA. You know? I think the kids are coming because they need help. They need help. Don't let them bring the skateboards into the meetings. I mean, I'm drawing the line. My home group is the Hermosa Beach Men's Stag, and it is the epicenter of sobriety. And, it's where the men are men and the sheep are nervous. And on any given Monday night, there's 100 to 110 guys in this room. And about 7 or 8 years ago, the kids started showing up. I mean, they were always kind of around, but they were mostly in the parking lot. But they started coming in the room, and they started getting sober. And a few years ago, there was a kid there who was 15 years old, taking a 1-year birthday cake. And in our room, everybody's sitting down. You got to stand up and stand at one end of the room. It's very intimidating. I used to think that I was a father figure. Then I realized I'm a grandfather figure. You know, it's like, but this kid who's, you know, 3'7", you know, stands up at the end of the room, and he gave the most right-wing death squad AA pitch I have ever heard. And at the end of it, he's standing there pointing his finger at us like this. And he says, and if you're sitting out there tonight and you're not working the steps and you don't have a sponsor, may God have mercy on your soul. So I went up and asked him to be my sponsor. I mean, for weeks after that, we were walking around looking at each other going, may God have mercy on your soul. Lightweight. So the kids are coming. The kids are coming. In the 1950s, there were two recovery programs, NA and AA. There are now 300 12-step programs. When they came up with Codependence Anonymous, they came up with a program that every living human being qualifies for. You know, everybody can work the steps. In Iran a few years ago, Muslim country, there's no alcohol, therefore no alcoholism, right? There can be no AA, it's not allowed because there's no alcohol, therefore there can't possibly be alcoholism. But evidently, drugs are illegal, but they're morally okay, so NA can be there. So NA in Tehran had a convention. 12,000 people showed up to the convention. There's not one as big as that in the U.S. Now, do you suppose there's some alcoholics hiding out in the NA meetings? Pretending to be drug addicts? So I think Alcoholics Anonymous is alive and well. And it's not up to me to choose who I get to work with or not. Whoever gets sent, that's what we do. It's not up to me to determine whether you qualify for AA or not. If it was up to me, I'd weed a few of you people out. I'm only half joking. In the 1950s, my father and my mother and a bunch of their friends were starting meetings. They were building the Alcoholics Anonymous that we now enjoy on the west coast of the United States. And I was part of that. I mean, I didn't know what was going on specifically. I was just a kid, but I would sit in the kitchen of the meeting and bring out the coffee and the donuts, and I heard all the talks and the pitches, and there were potlucks at our house, and we were constantly going to somebody else's house for a potluck, and, you know, we're going to Bakersfield. Now I know why we were going to Bakersfield all the time. There's no good reason to go to Bakersfield, but it was the Southern California Convention, and we would go there every year, and I'd be in the room, and I grew up with all the other kids, you know, the AA kids, and we were drinking. And at 13, I grew up in a house that had a lot of weird uncles around. You know, they'd be on the back porch waiting for their sponsor to come home when I'd come home from school. Many times I'd get them up and bring them in the house and kind of clean them off a little bit. You know, I mean, they weren't in good shape. And we had one weird uncle named Harold that was around all the time. Harold was always on the back porch. And my dad would take him to meetings and get him some clothes once in a while and put money in his pocket, give him jobs around the house and stuff. Harold was a cabinet maker, and he hadn't worked in a long time, and he didn't have a car, and he had no money, didn't have a place to live. And he couldn't get sober. He kept drinking all the time, you know. And one time I told him, I came home, and he's laying on the back porch. Here's a good description of hell. You're laying on somebody's back porch. It's a hot day. You're hungover, half drunk. And there's a 9-year-old kid in your ear going, you know, you're not supposed to drink. You know, I had that figured out. You know, I mean, Harold shouldn't drink. He wasn't having fun, you know. Finally, Harold got sober. He showed up and he had a car, he had a job, he got some nice clothes, he started looking better. He met a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went to the wedding when they got married. Then he got drunk. Then he got divorced. And I went to the funeral when he died, smoking in bed in a hotel, drunk, and burned himself alive. And I knew at 13 years old when that happened, I knew that the reason that that man died was not because it was some tragic accident. I knew that the reason he died was because he drank. I knew at 13 years old that when alcoholics drink, bad stuff happens. It's not a cute disease. It's not funny. Like some of the Budweiser commercials are kind of cute, you know, and you see some movies where they make fun of the drunk, but you and I have lived that life. The reason we laugh about it now is because it's not like that. When it's like that, it's not funny, is it? It's not cute. It's not pretty. Families get destroyed. Things get ruined. You know, sweet relationships are dead. And at 13 years old, I lost a friend. I lost Harold. I liked that man. He was nice to me. You'd think I'd get the message. I couldn't wait to drink. I couldn't wait. Remember waiting around for it? When's it going to happen? You have a few beers every now and then, you know, it's kind of cute. But finally, you get the job done. And a friend of mine's older brother had a party at his house, and he had us do something for him. And for that, we could drink whatever we wanted. And we did the old 16-ounce plastic cup and filled it full of all kinds and choked it down. And I caused some trouble at the party. And they loaded me up into a car and drove me back to my parents' house and dumped me out on the front lawn. I was probably 15 years old. And I crawled in the back of the house, and I crawled down the hallway and into my bedroom, and I'm laying on the bed with one foot on the floor to stop the spinning. And back in those days, we had these big black plastic things called records. I'm serious. And it had a little hole in the middle, and we played them on pieces of furniture called record players. And some of these pieces of furniture had a lid on it. So I puked in the record player. Crawled back down the hall, got into the bathroom. I'm sitting on the toilet with a trash can between my legs because by this time it's coming out both ends. Bathroom door opens up. I look up and there's my mother with this aghast expression on her face and my father standing behind her laughing hysterically. By the time I was 17 years old, I was a bad drunk in high school. I had the big jacket and the slouch and the sneer and the foul mouth and the bad attitude. You could not talk to me. I'd already been to jail. I was already in trouble. I mean, within a couple of years, I'm flunking out of high school and I'm going to jail and I'm in trouble. And it's okay with me. It was the 60s. It was the 60s. I graduated from high school in 1965. It was a great time to be getting loaded, you know? I mean, you'll hear people say, I wouldn't trade my worst day sober for my best day drunk. I wouldn't trade 66 and 67 for anything. I mean, from what I hear, it was a real hoot. The road from Los Angeles to San Francisco was a road to nirvana. Golden Gate Park was the center of the universe. They weren't eating hitchhikers yet, so it was safe to travel. You know? And the young ladies were discovering their sexuality, and we were helping them as best we could. You know? Fourth of July, Bass Lake, 1965. The Hells Angels rode into that valley, and I found my career path. I go, yeah, I want to be an outlaw, a gunslinger. A tough guy, you know. I mean, that's what a man is. That's what I want to be. So I chased that. I met her that weekend. She had long brown hair, and she let me have sex with her, so I married her. And we went up to Oregon to grow our own, and the party started. And my story, essentially, is I was a surfer and a biker and a tough guy. And I never went to the beach. My motorcycle rarely ran, and I was afraid to fight. But I looked really good. I had a chrome Nazi helmet for a hat and a primary chain for a belt and black greasy Levi's with big black boots, chains all around them. I've got tattoos all over me, but I had a clip-on earring because I didn't want to hurt myself. My biker nickname is Horny. I have it tattooed on my arm right here, and it's misspelled. H-O-R-N-E-Y. Horney. Every time I'm thinking a little bit too much of myself, I look at that tattoo. It keeps me centered. I mean, there were three of us that night when I got that tattoo, and we determined that's how you spell it. It was not a unilateral decision. It was a group effort, and me and the rest of my rocket scientist buddies. And at 22 years old, I ended up in the Oregon State Mental Institution. I needed a rest. We had gotten married, we had two children, and I was running with this outlaw motorcycle gang and not coming home, and it was a nightmare. 22, I'm in a mental institution. Not much of a party. It was a real short party. You know, for some people, they drank successfully for a period of time, and they stepped over a line. I never knew there was a line. I mean, I'm drinking for the blackout. That's okay with me. I want out of here. I don't like this world. This is your world. It's not mine. I don't like it here. I want out. And I drank like that. And I used like that. I was sticking needles in my arm every day and drinking like a fish. And you know, I essentially abandoned that family, and I ended up in a mental institution at 22 years old. Now, every one of us tells the story of how before we drank, we didn't feel part of. We felt separate from. There was a big hole and we couldn't seem to fill it. We have different ways of describing this. You know, the aliens dropped us off and we're waiting for the mothership to return. You know, I mean, we all have a way of telling. Now, we talk about that experience as if it's a unique experience, that only alcoholics suffer from that. I think every kid feels that way. Every kid feels isolated and not connected. We have the authority. They don't, and they don't like it. You ever raise teenagers? They're aliens, you know? I mean, they're 9, 10 years old, and you're their favorite toy. And then that day comes where you see that look in their eye where you are the stupidest person they have ever met in their life. And you can see them step away from you, you know? The difference between us and them is we medicated that, and we never grew out of it. And now that we're sober, we're going to do it now. We're going to grow up now. And when people are describing this thing about feeling alienated, they'll use a term like alcoholic thinking, as if there is such a thing. You know? I mean, we say it enough, and go, oh, shit, he's got alcoholic thinking. My kid thinks like an alcoholic. Oh, my God, you know, I got to start saving money for the bail bond fund, you know? Silkworth heard us use that term in 1940 or 41, immediately went and wrote a paper about it. Can you imagine him sitting in the early meetings? Oh, God, they're making stuff up now, you know? And he wrote a paper on emotional sobriety. In the workshop that I did this afternoon, part of the Akron Manual talks about that we don't think like adults. There's no alcoholic thinking. And we talk about this like it's an excuse for how we operate. The truth is, the rest of the therapeutic community never uses the term alcoholic thinking. What they say about us is that we are emotionally immature. And we hear that and we go, no. I have special thinking. I have alcoholic thinking, and it's never going away. And you need to consider that when you're dealing with me. I have special thinking. My own personal experience is that I'm emotionally immature. And now that I'm sober, I'm going to have a series of experiences that I missed when I was a kid because I was loaded. If I had the experience, I was loaded and I missed whatever the lesson was. Most of the experiences I missed completely because I wasn't even in the room. And now I'm going to do it now. And the chances of me growing up in Alcoholics Anonymous and looking good are really slim. I'm going to behave badly. I'm going to say the wrong things. I'm going to trip over my own feet. And I will probably chase myself out of the rooms if it gets painful enough. But at 22 years old, I'm in a mental institution. Anybody else here been in a mental institution? Oh, come on. There's a bunch of you out there going, well, it really wasn't an institution. They were just observing me. I got a little sketchy, you know. Only those of us that have been in the mental institution know that it's not that bad. You have some sparkling conversations in the mental institution. It's an eclectic crowd. It's a great place to look for a bride. I'd like to introduce you to my wife, Karen. I didn't meet her in the mental institution, unless you count AA, you know. I did two little tours of duty in the mental institution, and the state of Oregon decided I should leave, and I agreed. And I came back down to Los Angeles and tried to get normal. And my father, sober a long time, but I hated my father, which is one of the requirements for being an alcoholic. You must hate your parents. And guys come to me and say, no, I love my parents. And go, oh, you need to work on that. You know? This is part of the deal, you know. Mom and dad are the first ones to insert themselves into the fun process, you know. And I really hated my father. But he let me sleep in his garage, and he gave me a job in his machine shop in El Segundo. I tried to get normal. And what normal is for an alcoholic of my variety is you got to quit shooting heroin because you can't get anybody to go along with the concept of social heroin use. It's pretty much a lifestyle. You got to quit taking LSD because normal people have two-way communication with each other. Acid is not conducive to that. It's pretty much a one-sided kind of a conversation. You can only drink on the weekends because normal people have jobs that they go to days in a row. I've seen them do it. I've watched them. You know, week after week, day after. It's incredible. When I drink, I don't show up no matter what. Everything stops. So what you do during the week is you smoke pot because it's green and it's from God and it's not really drugs. It's what you do in between getting really loaded. Because I don't know about you, but the impact of your personality on me is devastating. I cannot do you. I need something in me to cushion the blow of you on me. I can't just walk around with naked blood and stuff. I need medication all the time, every day. I need some form of medication just to get through the day. Remember, no party. This is not partying, you know. This is surviving the day. This is survival drinking, survival drug use, to just get through the day, to try to get to show up to work, you know, to live in this world. I need something like that. I can't survive without it. The other thing about an alcoholic of my variety is I need to find a woman because somebody's got to take care of me. You know, somebody has to cook. You know, or I can't feed myself. I'm absolutely helpless. And there are volunteers out there that will take on our case, you know. And I met her, we set up housekeeping together. And I went along this path, this marijuana maintenance, drinking on the weekends kind of thing, for another 15 years. At 37 years old, I'm living in the house with this wife. We have two more children. And I had no emotional connection to another living human being. And I did not know that. I didn't know that it was like that. I didn't know that it was that bad. I can't step outside myself and have a separate experience and then gauge it against the one that I'm actually living. I don't know that I'm that disconnected. I figure that I'm connected. I don't even think about it. But I didn't know that. I knew something was horribly wrong. You ever drank yourself clear? You ever had that experience where you're drinking and you're not going away? That's hell. That's hell. I drank myself clear. I don't know what it looked like from the outside, but you're standing right in front of me and you're not disappearing. You know, I'm hearing the words that you're saying to me and I don't like this. I'm not going away anymore. What do you do when that happens? Where do we go? What do we do? Some people blow their heads off. But like any good gangster, I called my mom. Next time you see some big badass guy walk in here, ask him, do you live with your mom? Chances are. You know, back to the party thing. I think the whole idea, this idea of not being connected and having this big hole inside, part of the story that we tell, the end of the story, is we have a couple of drinks and it gets better. It gets better. The hole fills up. You know, I get smarter. I feel better. I can communicate with you. So let's get it. The whole idea, I think, was to have a couple of pops and then get out of the house and go to the party and have some adventures and enjoy life. I ended up naked in my living room watching religious television, taking notes. Party! You know? I mean, I'm having sex, menage a uno. There's no one else in the room, you know. We're partying with Billy now, you know. The next time you see somebody walk in here and says, well, I'm just a party kind of guy, ask him, how many other people were at the party? My mother came and got me, quickly, the Al-Anon, quickly, before I changed my mind, before I sobered up too much. And she drove me to a place in Costa Mesa called Starting Point. And I spent 35 days in there. Now, I'd been to AA. My father was sober, and I'd been to a lot of meetings, but I could not imagine just coming to AA and not drinking. I don't know what my motivation was. My parents sent me to my first shrink when I was 13 years old because I had rage. Not anger, rage. Just, I would throw myself on the floor, pound my head into walls. My mother would look at this and say, there's something wrong with the boy, you know, and she sent me to a shrink, and I spent a year and a half with this guy, and he helped me, and he introduced me to my favorite subject, me, that lifelong pursuit of self, the idea that there is a root cause to my problems, and if we go in there and flesh it out, expose it to the light of day, understand it intellectually, we can adjust our behavior accordingly, and then everything will be okay. It sounds really plausible. I don't think it works. You know, I was an insight junkie. I had many insights. And then I'd drink a gallon of wine and think about it some more. You know, nothing ever changed. Year and a half at 13, I spent two tours of duty in the mental institution. I spent 2.5 years in group therapy at one time. I've been to several other shrinks and therapists and stuff. I've been gestalted and rolfed and primal screened. I know more about myself than is safe to know. But it is my favorite subject. So when it was time for me to get help, I couldn't imagine just coming here. I need to be put away somewhere. I need therapy and I need some medication. So I spent 35 days in this place. While I was in there, they made me wear a sign around my neck. I had to make the sign. We made it in crafts. It was a little rectangular piece of cardboard with a string that went through it, and it said, I am not a counselor. Because evidently, there was some confusion about that. So at the end of 35 days, they let me out. They just let us out like we're okay now, you know. Go forth, multiply, you know. Where do we end up? Here. This is the world's aftercare program. It's linoleum floors and metal folding chairs for the rest of our natural lives. It's Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the only, there is no other place. There are no referrals from AA. Did you know that? There's no place you go where you walk in and you say, I'm from AA. They sent me here. This is it. We are the counselors. The inmates are running the asylum. It's not therapy. It's not a self-help organization. It's not a support group. It is none of those things. And the psychotherapeutic community tries to make it that. It's not adversarial. They're not trying, they're just trying to reflect it in their practices. And, oh, it's people with like problems supporting each other. Oh, we get it, you know. But it isn't that, is it? When you get into it, it isn't like that. So what happens here? Why are we here? What do we do now? You hear people, lots of people talk about, well, he's working his program, I'm working mine, she's working a great program. And, you know, they talk about it like there's all these different programs. You'll even hear some people in AA say, there's a different program for everyone in Alcoholics Anonymous. Make one for yourself. Really? You're going to allow me, with this finely tuned instrument, to determine my pathway into recovery. When was the last time I made a good value judgment about anything like that, you know? Really? Really? Don't make it too comfortable for me. It's time for me to work your program, not mine. And there's only one. There's only one program. And it's the same for everybody. And I think it's what keeps us here. We have a way out upon which we all agree. Yes, we all hit a bottom of some sort. We came from a negative place. We show up here. I don't believe that's what keeps us together, the identification with that negative place we came from. I think it's the way out that we all agree on that keeps us together. Even if we're not doing it, we know what it is. We know what it is. You ever had anybody say to you, he's not emotionally available for me? You ever heard that? They say it to us in many ways. You don't listen to me when I talk to you. You're not there for me. I don't feel connected to you. You just don't get it, do you? They say it to us in many different ways. I think what they mean by that is that we're not connected to them. The illusion is, when they say that to us, is that I've got something that they want, and I'm withholding it. The truth is worse. I don't have it. But I don't know that I don't have it. You've convinced me that I've got it, and I'm helping you look for it. And this dance is going to go on forever. Forever. There is no conspiracy. The depth of my shallowness knows no bounds. There is the illusion that I had something once, and we're going to uncover it, and then I'll be there for you. I never developed it. It never happened for me. It has to be developed in me. And if I spend all my time in the past trying to flesh out the root cause of my problems, I'm going to completely miss what I'm unfolding into today that has no connection to my past at all. This is a brand new life, and it has nothing to do with me. Therefore, how could I possibly grasp it? I'm only interested in me. I'm truly not interested in you. I'm just waiting for you to stop talking. Now that I'm sober, if you would like me to be intimate with you, and what I mean by intimacy is when I can feel what you feel. I'm not just reacting to how you feel impacts me. I can actually feel what you feel. I think that's what you're talking about when you're trying to describe this to me. You want to feel some connection to me, like we're on the same wavelength, we're on the same path, that you don't have to describe everything to me. I'll just kind of get it. I'm sensitive to you when you actually come into the room. I'm not looking around you trying to get at the television, you know? Yes, great, yeah, you know? That kind of stuff. You hate that when I do that. I don't even notice that I'm doing that. I'm not doing anything to you. That truly is how disconnected I am from you. And I think I love you. I'll even use that term. Now that I'm sober, if you would like me to be intimate with you, it's going to take about 10 years. And I'll promise you something. If all I do in that 10 years is go to 875,000 meetings, nothing will change. Nothing. It won't even get a little bit better. I'll just hide out in AA to stay away from you, because I don't like what's in your eyes. I don't want to confront that situation. I don't know anything about intimacy, and I don't even know that. I think I'm okay. And at the end of that 10 years, you'll be standing in front of me telling me that I'm not connected to you, and I'll be screaming at you, "What the hell do you want from me?" And I'm here to report to you, I don't get it. I'm not making it up. I am that stupid. I just don't get it. If, on the other hand, I work some steps and I work with others and I get involved in this program, I'm going to go through a series of experiences that at the end of a 10-year period, I'm going to have an inkling of what you're talking about. I will never learn it from you. I'll learn it with these other men that I'm trying to reach out to. It is the men in AA that will teach me intimacy, not the women. I'm afraid of them. I can't deal with that. They're objects to me. The first step says that I'm powerless. They took it easy on us. They said that we're powerless over alcohol because they didn't want us to run screaming down the street. After 25 years of rather deep research, I've yet to find anything that I have any power over at all. I think I am utterly powerless. I think that's the way it is in nature. Nature, the power that drives the universe, does not require me to help it with the unfolding of all things. It just seems to occur with or without me. I am rarely consulted on these things. But my keen intellect will label these things right and wrong, good and bad. Therein lies my suffering. Something horrible will happen. I'll say, that's horrible. It should not have happened. So now I'm hurt by what happened, and I have suffering by determining that it should never have happened. And yet, there it is. The lion eats the lamb every single time. I don't believe the lamb makes any kind of moral judgment on the lion. It's just really upset about being eaten. But there's no deep philosophy involved in this. And yet I will label these things. This finely tuned instrument of mine labels stuff. My sponsor said to me one time, he said, "Have you ever considered the fact that you could be completely wrong?" No. No, as a matter of fact, no. I've never considered that.
One time he asked me, he says, do you think about what you think about? What? So I think the truth is that I'm powerless and I don't need any power. I do not believe this is bad news. I think this is good news, because even if I think it's not true, it still is, and I suffer. But I don't need any power. Therefore, how could I possibly manage my life? Managers have power. I have none. So my life is totally unmanageable by me. Doesn't require any management by me, as a matter of fact. It just unfolds. The alarm goes off. You get up. You go to work. This is not rocket science. It just happens. It doesn't require any management from me. The only kind of management I give it is, well, things are going along in this direction. Let's completely change course and go over here for a while. And that gives me the illusion of power. Now I have chosen. Well, you can get deep into that and determine maybe not. Maybe it's just the way it's supposed to be. Powerless and unmanageable. If I can grasp this concept, the second step becomes operational. I need a manager. I need something that will come into my life and restore me to sanity. Certainly enough sanity not to drink and use, but also enough sanity to really recognize how powerless and unmanageable I am. To get that in a non-intellectual way, to understand it, and to have that be okay. If I can grasp that, then the third step becomes operational. What do? Well, I turn my life and will over to it. What life and will? The fourth step. The resentments, fears, and broken relationships. Resentment, certainly, because you absolutely refuse to live the way I need you to live for me to be happy. And I get pissed off at my core about that. I'm not just a little bit upset. It changes my life. Fear? Because I know this isn't working and I don't have any alternatives, so I'm frightened, of course. Broken relationships, if what I'm bringing to the table is resentment and fear, how could I have anything other but that? Broken relationships, dysfunctional relationships. The fifth step is the ceremony that you and I go through to complete the third step. We tell ourselves and another human being, maybe for the first time in our lives, and this manager, here's my stuff, you take it, I'm pooped. I can't do this anymore. I have no alternative, but this is not working. Six and seven are about character defects. It's two paragraphs in the book. There's nothing for us to do, but we can see what the character defects are. They're in the fourth column of the resentment list. It says my faults and mistakes, not my part. It says my faults and mistakes. And you can see what they are. I'm judgmental, I'm prejudiced, I'm arrogant, I'm pompous, I'm vindictive. All of whatever your cute little mix of stuff is, you can see what it is. There they are in glowing color. The longer we're sober, the more of these inventories we do, the more that fourth column gets larger and larger and larger and more in depth. Because now we're looking for it. I'm under no illusion anymore that it is your fault. It is never your fault. It's always got something to do with me. The manager then gives us our first assignment. He says, I'm going to help you rid yourself of these resentments. We're going to go out and make amends, make a list. So I go about the process of paying back the money, giving them back their money, and making my apologies and working my way down that list. Now, at the end of the ninth step, am I capable of being intimate? No. Not even close. 1 through 9 are 15% of the program. It's sober 101. I have to do this stuff in order to have any kind of a message that has depth and weight that will carry me into the function of the steps that will change my life. This is just the basic stuff, and we agonize over it. We have workbooks, manuals, weekend-long workshops, 15-column expanded inventories. It's pathetic. It's all about us again. Inventory after inventory after inventory. And we wonder why it's not getting any better. We wonder why it's not getting any better. People say that 10, 11, and 12 are the maintenance steps. Maintain what? What do I have now? Is this just about not drinking? I don't think so. I think there's a lot more than that going on here. If I want to be comfortable in this sobriety, it's about changing my life. It's about living your life for a while, about doing something completely different. 10, 11, and 12 are 85% of the program. It's where the recovery actually occurs. The 10th step is about having awareness, about waking up and being aware that we're awake, being able to watch myself move through life. It's the continuing inventory process. There's a difference between self-obsession and self-awareness. And what we're talking about now is self-awareness. The 11th step is about sucking up to the manager. It's about getting close to whatever it is that has saved my life, whatever that might be. In meditation, which my sponsor loves to say is not extra credit. In meditation, he says to me all the time, Bill, you will be reduced to prayer and meditation. And that has happened more than once. But in meditation, I can have the experience of watching my thoughts. Whoa. Watching my thoughts. I can actually experience the reality of, I am not my thinking mind. That is a game changer there. If I can really come to that understanding, truly experience that, to know at depth, in a non-intellectual understanding, I am not my thinking mind. My head, we talk about it in AA, we talk about our head in the third person. I think we screwed up and got it right. We say things like, my head is out to get me. Well, I don't think it's out to get me. I think it's trying to help. It's just stupid. I mean, stop and think about it. What's it got to work with? The past. That's it. It's got the past. So it takes the past and it projects it into the future. Remember how miserable it was? It's going to be that way again. Look out. You know, we need some medication because this one's going to hurt. You know, it can't live in the present moment. There's nothing for it to do because there's nothing wrong in the present moment. Everything's absolutely as it should be. How could it be any other way? All we have is the present. Do you and I live there? Hell no. We're in the past or in the future, usually filled with fear and trepidation. Or injustice, wrongdoing, all of those things. We label it all, we chew on it, we wrestle around with it, we think about it. Do you ever catch yourself alone in a room thinking about your problems? Get the hell out of the room. Nothing positive will be generated in that activity. So the 11th step shows me that I don't have to change my mind. I don't have to do battle with it. I can simply ignore the thing. Just ignore it. When it comes up with one of its wonderful scenarios, just close your eyes and look at it and go, that's interesting. What else you got? You know? It means nothing. It creates nothing. It does nothing. And I can just ignore it. And the longer you work at this, the easier it gets. I don't have to clear my mind of thoughts. I can concentrate on the breathing and just not buy into whatever it's coming up with. The 12th step is the mechanism that this manager uses to help us confront our defects of character. I cannot recover without you. You will hear people in AA say, you've got to give it away to keep it. No. You've got to give it away to even get it. If you're not giving it away, you don't have it. If you're sitting out there tonight and you're sober 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 15, 20, 30 years, and you're waiting for your ship to come in, it ain't coming. It's not coming. If I'm not working with other people one-on-one, I'm never going to confront my defects of character. Why would I ever consciously put myself in a position to be uncomfortable? Why would I ever make that decision? I've spent my entire life making sure that I am never uncomfortable. That's my goal as an alcoholic, to medicate everything, to make sure that I'm always comfortable. Now in recovery, I'm suddenly going to decide, oh yeah, let's go get uncomfortable and change. You know? That'll be fun. You know? That is not going to be my first inclination. So don't be too easy on me. Recovery, by its very nature, is uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable not drinking. When you sit in a room and you're working with a guy and you give him a 20-minute lecture on how he should live his life, and then he leaves the room, and you think to yourself, that's some good stuff. I should try that. You run headlong into your own hypocrisy. I was 8 years sober, 9 years sober. My whole life blew up. I left my wife and children and ended up living in a storeroom over my office. Everything got turned upside down. My reputation in Alcoholics Anonymous was shot to hell, which was a shame because at the time I was president of AA. But there was a coup. And a lot of people were very happy to see my downfall. I was an asshole. And I've made a lot of amends in Alcoholics Anonymous for the way I've treated people over the years. I didn't know that I was phony. I didn't know. But the phony biker with the clip-on earring hadn't gone away when I stopped drinking. The little tiny frightened little boy that's 6'5" and 280 pounds and loud to cover up that fear hadn't gone away. Same guy. Same guy. Stone cold sober. Same guy. I went to my sponsor and I said, I need some help. He said, go find God. Go find your higher power. And I said, please don't give me mindless platitudes. I need some real practical help. And he yelled in my face, he said, Bill, there is nothing else. You talk a good game, go do it. And I almost hit him. And I had to start over just like anybody else. Reading the stuff in the morning, getting quiet, going to meetings whether I wanted to or not. A lot of the guys I sponsored fired me for just cause. And a lot of people left and a lot of people stayed. A lot of people were there at the base of the tree to catch me when I fell out of the tree. I didn't much like what they had to say to me. It's the old tough love. We call the truth tough love, so we don't really have to face the truth, you know. I mean, what they said to me was the truth about who I was. My sponsor said to me one time, he says, Bill, maybe one day you'll get it. And I said, get what? And he says, it isn't what you say that pisses people off, it's how you say it. It's who you are they don't like. It was like somebody stabbed me in the chest with a pair of shears. But I knew he was telling the truth. I can't recover without you. You are an integral part of the process. This manager lives in the space between you and I. And the closer I am to you, the closer I am to the manager. My problems are so huge it takes the power that drives the entire universe to solve them. And when I sit quietly and I concentrate on my breath to try to come into the present moment, I have another experience. I come to understand that I am not breathing. I am being breathed. I don't think about breathing. It just happens. And when I'm in that space, I believe I'm close to that power that drives the entire universe. It is the basis for which we all are living here. That's what saves us. That's the connection that saves us. And you bring that to me. When I get on my knees and ask for help, I should not send it away when it shows up. And it's going to look a lot like you. You're going to bring that message to me. I will see myself through your eyes much better than I will ever flesh it out on my own. Should everybody do this work? Absolutely. There is nothing else to do here. There is no other job. Everything else is an activity. There's a reason why you and I were saved. And you and I will come up with lots of excuses why we don't want to be inconvenienced by the presence of other people in our lives. There's two rules that I live by. These rules have changed my life, and I believe they would change yours. If you're having the trouble, if you're identifying with anything I'm saying here tonight, answer the phone whenever it rings. Get rid of caller ID. Have faith that whoever is being sent into your life is supposed to be there. Stop controlling the experience. Let it happen. Let it unfold. Number two, never say no. Have faith that you'll be sent where you're supposed to be with whoever you're supposed to be with, no matter how big of a mistake it looks like. You end up in Thailand when you do that. You know? Have faith. We are not the manager. I am powerless and I don't need any power. You and I together are a powerful force. David Hawkins says that Alcoholics Anonymous is probably the single most significant social movement of the 20th century. That in North America alone, it has touched the lives of 300 million people. All the AA, all the spin-offs, all the 12-step programs. It's changed the face of this planet. It has changed the consciousness of this planet. That's where you and I are, in the single most significant social movement of the 20th century. And we're into a different century now. And when they look back on us, if we last hundreds of years, they're going to say that you and I were the pioneers of Alcoholics Anonymous. We are the members in the first 100 years of the growth of this organization, the changing of the consciousness of the entire world. And I don't think I'm blowing it out of proportion. I think it's real. I travel a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have never seen anything like this. I have never felt the energy that I feel in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's nowhere else I've been that even compares to this. And we'll waste it by sitting around thinking about ourselves, sharing in meetings about how my day went, as if that's going to help us. Alcoholics Anonymous is about recovery from alcoholism. It's a spiritual path that is as powerful and dynamic as any other spiritual path. It encompasses all spiritual paths. Everyone gets to come. No one gets left out. God bless it.
Thank you very much, Bill. That was fantastic. Okay. Bill's going to be back tomorrow morning for another session. The festivities get underway at 9 a.m. You can check the schedule outside on your way out. I have a brief announcement about if you please ask everyone to turn off the radios for the translation equipment. After